Membership fees apply after free trial. Cancel any time.
Okay, so why do people love my Total Body Bar workouts? Because they work. My clients get an amazing workout and great results. I'm Andrea Rogers, professional dancer and trainer, and my Extend Bar classes are fun, only 30 minutes, and proven to help you get sculpted, lean, and strong. And right now, you can stream my Extend Bar classes for free on the Beachbody On Demand app. See how effective these workouts truly are. Start for free today at Beachbody.com.
Please stand clear of the doors. Por favor, manténganse alejado de las puertas.
Hey everybody, welcome to Unlocking the Magic, episode number 149. We have a very special show to you, for you today. We have, actually it's a repeat guest on the show today.
Not our children.
He's our new best friend, or at least my new best friend.
Definitely.
I think maybe Bruce might be a little jealous. I'm just kidding. He's the author of The Thinking Fan's Guide, Walt Disney World, Epcot. And also the host of the Zippity Doo Pod. I'm talking about Aaron Wallace.
I was excited to have Aaron back on. This wasn't necessarily an interview. It's more of a conversation.
It's a conversation more so because he did just release his newest book a few months back. And I'm dying to read it. And I was really excited to talk about this book because it's everything I've always wanted in a book. Learning and digesting and reading about Epcot.
Yeah, it was a pretty good book. I went over the chapters on Amazon. I'm going to get into it. Hopefully it comes out on Audible because that's my style.
That is your style.
But if you get the book and you read it, I'll definitely check it out. I did try to do an intro with Aaron when he was on the air, but I totally botched it. So you're going to hear that in a second.
Wonderful.
I really don't like doing the intros while people are on with us. I'd rather do these intros later and then just kind of have a conversation start because I feel like it's more natural that way.
It's so nerve-wracking. I think going back when we had Marty Sklar and Rolly Crump on, it's so nerve-wracking to have them on the air with us and then introduce them. I don't like it because it's like, oh, I just want to give them that special introduction that they deserve, but it's like it's so much pressure.
And you just want to start the conversation. It feels exactly. It's a little bit awkward. Not going to lie.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
You know, before we get into the episode, go check us out on Facebook. We go live every Monday night. If you're just new to the podcast, subscribe on iTunes and also go like us on Facebook, Unlocking the Magic over there. We do a live show kind of like this, but a little more fun and less structured on Monday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern time. So I just want to throw that in there before we get into the episode with Aaron.
All right, let's get into it.
Aaron Wallace joins us again. He was on the show back in October of 2016. We talked about his other book that he had. He recently has a new book that's coming out called Thinking Fan's Guide to Epcot. Excited to have Aaron back on the show.
First, I already messed it up. It's Thinking Fan's Guide to Walt Disney World, Epcot.
Oh, all right. Let me redo that.
It's a longer title than the new Guardians of the Galaxy ride at Disneyland.
Yes. All right. We'll start that over.
Well, I want to thank you, Aaron, for joining us once again. I just love having you on. We have so much in common. And I am a fangirl now. I'm a true Aaron Wallace fangirl.
You are the first.
That can't be true. Not at all. But Bruce and I were talking, and when we had you on the show way back, which seems like forever ago, it was back in October, we discussed, there's a lot of our friends over at Unlocking Magic that actually they heard you for the very first time on our show. So I thought it would be fun before we get really far into it today that we kind of do kind of like get to know Aaron Wallace a little bit more. So like I was thinking maybe like three things we may not know about you, but that we should, not to put you on the spot.
Oh my gosh, I'm so on the spot, but no, it's good. It's a good thing. Well, let me first say thank you so much for having me back on. I am a big fan of you guys, too, and this is my second time on this show. We did the Facebook Live thing, too, and it's really cool to you know, get to talk to your listeners and to unlock the magic with you guys. So I appreciate being back here. So for those who don't know, yeah, I've been doing the podcasting thing for actually 13 years this week. 13 years ago, my Disney podcast, which is called Zippity Doo Pod, started. I think it's somehow now the longest running Disney podcast out there, even though there haven't been a ton of episodes. But it's just sort of a show for taking a deeper look at all things Disney and fundamentally why we love them. You know, what drives us to movies, to theme park attractions, and just sort of taking a step back and reflecting on the big picture and what it is that at its heart about Disney that speaks to us. And then kind of from that spring, this book series called The Thinking Fan's Guide to Disney. And there have been three books in that, Magic Kingdom, Hocus Pocus, the Halloween movie, randomly enough, and then this new book on Epcot. So that's sort of my thing. But three things that people don't know. Oh, my gosh.
This could, if somebody was to reverse this on me, I would be totally.
Skype would accidentally crash and for some reason on Connie's phone only. The thing that I want to say is I love your approach to what you do on your podcast and in your books, because it's kind of like what we do. We kind of unlock these certain attractions or resorts. I'm kind of giving you a time to stall here, Aaron, so you can think about that question.
Good job, Bruce.
And I like your approach. It's like taking a step back, not necessarily rushing through these things and, you know, appreciating the small details and what goes on inside all of these attractions, resorts, parks, more than just the things that everybody talks about. And I like that approach.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And yeah, I think that's why, you know, it's a good fit for us to be talking together. And I think so many people are into this idea, because when you first enter the Disney fandom, just on a superficial level, like the parks, for example, are so wowing, right? I mean, it's sensory overload the first couple of times you go there. And there's just this whole orientation period where you don't even know if you should turn left or right to get to the next attraction, because it's all just sort of a blur. And then as you start to become more familiar with these places, you sort of sink deeper into another level of love. It really is like a relationship, a bond that forms with these places. And that connects with this bond that you remember from childhood when you were first exposed to these wonderful films that Walt created, then the movies from the 90s renaissance. And so it just all sort of comes together. And then I think the great thing about living in this current, you know, age, the last 10 years or so, is that fans, right? Just we're all just Disney fans, and you know, the company produces some great content for fans, but like, we need more than what they put out. So we just are able to create things now with technology, you know, podcasts, blogs, books, whatever it may be. And we're all, you know, learning from that together and teaching each other. So it's such a cool time to be a Disney fan. And it is easier than ever to learn about the park's history and to really like get that deeper appreciation. I was just listening to an interview with the voice of Rod Serling in the Tower of Terror attraction. This was on the Disney Coast to Coast podcast. Yeah, and he was talking about how he was a Disney parks geek, interestingly enough, like growing up, long before he ever knew he would be involved in one of the most classic attractions ever. And he would actually call into Disney and just ask random questions, like how tall are the animatronics in Pirates of the Caribbean, because he was just such a fan. But there was no internet. There was no way to find all of this stuff out. And he said he actually ended up talking to a young Tom Fitzgerald, who, you know, is now like an Imagineering legend, who would give him all of these facts and stats. And like, that was the only way to get it then. So,
wow. I mean,
that's a cool story. But thank God we are, you know, now Disney fans in this generation, and we don't have to bug Tom Fitzgerald on the phone.
Although it would be nice.
It would be.
I'm sure you can find him on Twitter or Facebook or something like that now and ask him those questions over the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll send Tom Fitzgerald an email and quiz him on his Pirates of the Caribbean.
Have him come on the show and do an episode with you.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot now. Back to those three questions. What do you got for us?
Okay, so I've got – so these are just things people don't know about me. All right. One – people might know this, but I have interviewed in person, like face-to-face. I'm going to try to make these Disney-related, right?
Perfect.
Of course.
Two current Disney executives. Can you guess who they might be?
Ooh, this is exciting. Bruce, there's
current
some pressure on you.
Disney executives. Are they for the parks?
They are involved in the parks, but not like first and foremost parks people.
Then I have no idea.
One's a creative and one's kind of a head honcho.
Hmm. tricky. How did you get these people? I'm just like fascinated by even like having.
Well, okay. So the face-to-faces, these were both at the world premiere of the first Cars. That's kind of another hint.
Huh. John Lasseter?
John Lasseter, that's one of them.
No.
Yeah, and he was so cool and personable and wearing a Hawaiian shirt, of course, with like a blazer over it because it's a fancy event. he was super nice and candid. And then the other person, quite a bit higher up the totem pole, at the top of it even.
Bob Iger?
Bob Iger, yeah.
That's amazing. Both of those guys in person you got an interview with.
Yeah, yeah. Bob Iger's was super short, actually, because at the time, so I was stationed on the red carpet at this media event beside a guy from an ABC affiliate. And at the time, the Walt Disney Company was in the process of offloading a lot of the ABC affiliates. And so it directly affected this journalist's job. And he was hammering Bob Iger. Like, his news had just broken, I think, like the day of the Cars premiere. So this guy was hammering Bob Iger with questions about this. And he clearly did not want to talk about it. So Bob was like running away from our section of the red carpet.
But in
the brief time I had with him, he was actually super, super genuine. And so that was cool.
I can't believe I got both of those and Connie didn't get one.
What? Yeah. No, I see. Okay. I was giving you, Bruce, the opportunity to shine since, you know, I can't always shine.
Sure.
It's not fair. No, but I really, those names were like, okay, those are the names that I thought of, but I was like, there's no way. How'd you get those? That's awesome.
I was thinking of trying to think of more obscure people that maybe not the obvious, but those are big names.
Those are great names. How? Jeez.
I've heard John Lasseter's a nice guy. Is he like he is on the interviews you see on either on TV or on YouTube or stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Just totally John Lasseter. You know, the cool thing, like it's even weird to call him an executive. I mean, he absolutely is one, but you know, that's kind of like not his shtick. It's not his persona because he was just... Yeah, he was this filmmaker, and even before that, he was a fan and like a Disneyland cast member. So, you know, he seems so much more grassroots, I think, than other Disney suits.
Right. He definitely is not what you think of when you think of an executive.
Yeah, definitely not. Okay, a second fact, and this is sort of tangentially Disney, but it's relevant to the D23 Expo, which is coming up, is that I was born on the exact date that the Golden Girls premiered. On NBC.
Okay.
September 14th, 1985.
Drop the mic. That's epic.
85, you're a baby.
Yeah, I'm 31. But so so the show's now 31, right? But I guess this year marks the 25th anniversary of the series finale of The Golden Girls, which of course was a Disney produced and created show. And so that is why there is now, I don't know if you guys have heard, there's this event coming up at the D23 Expo that is celebrating The Golden Girls.
I actually didn't hear that.
No.
Yeah. So it was just announced like within the last week. They just, at the last minute, they announced this whole slew of really awesome last minute events. Like there's another one where Whoopi Goldberg is my favorite actress. Oh, can that be my third fact? Because I didn't have one.
Sure.
Whoopi Goldberg, I am campaigning for to become a Disney legend. She is going to be presenting an hour and a half long presentation in the nighttime on the history of Disney live action musical songs. Like, how specific and random is that? So cool. but here's the thing. I think maybe the real reason she's there is because she's going to become the secret Disney Legends inductee.
Maybe. Ooh, that's an interesting...
How many Disney movies was she a part of?
So, well, Disney proper, there's just been a handful. You know, obviously The Lion King, Toy Story 3.
I forgot she was in The Lion King.
Yeah. But
you did?
Yeah.
How could you forget that?
I don't remember much. That's the problem.
it's a small role, but yeah, memorable because you know her hyena has the dreadlocks. It's kind of like
right.
But the bulk of her filmmaking career actually was with Touchstone Pictures and Hollywood Pictures. So you know everything from you know the Sister Act movies, which were you know, kind of early hits for Touchstone, things like The Associate and Eddie and things like that. You know, these were all Disney movies. So kind of on the non-Disney branded side, that was like the bulk of her career. And then she's done a lot of promotional stuff for the parks. And of course, The View now. She's been doing stuff for like a decade. And so do you guys remember Johnny Depp being the surprise inductee at the last expo?
I do. I remember hearing about it on online in he had a
hearing
surprising speech.
Online.
Yeah, well, I remember him people talking about his speech was a little bit weird.
In true Johnny Depp fashion.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's weird, yeah. Right?
Well, and then you kind of just come to realize that Johnny Depp's kind of weird in person.
Exactly.
Oh my! See, he's doing this to me because I've been on this like Johnny Depp fangirl thing lately because I absolutely love Pirates of the Caribbean. So he's kind of sick of hearing it.
I've heard some of that, Connie.
Okay.
But I appreciate that. Johnny Depp, I think, is a great, you know, his greatest films have probably not come from the last few years, but I do think he is a great actor.
Yeah.
He's definitely a great character actor.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
Because any movie that he's not a character and he's kind of like a normal human, he's terrible at.
Okay, Bruce. I've heard this way too much.
All right. Let's move on.
Moving on. Yeah. Those are really cool. Yeah.
I am quoted. This is a better third fact, I think, than Whoopi Goldberg.
Okay.
I am quoted in a Johnny Depp biography.
Are you really?
Wait.
Yeah, because I interviewed Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio about 10 years ago on right before I think the third Pirates of the Caribbean film came out. So they were the creators and the writers of Pirates of the Caribbean. They also did Treasure Planet, the Shrek movies, and a whole bunch of stuff. And so I interviewed them about Johnny Depp and how he approached the character of Jack Sparrow, and like how much of that was what they created and how much of it is what he improvised as a character actor. And so that interview made its way into one of the, you know, I'm sure there are a million biographies on Johnny Depp, but this is just one of them. So there's a third fact.
How much of that character that he plays is improvised on his behalf?
So the writers gave him quite a bit of credit for that, and I don't know how much of that was just sort of like a professional deference to Johnny Depp, but they did give him a lot of credit. And I believe it, honestly, that a lot of Jack Sparrow emanates from him because, like you said, Johnny Depp's a weird guy, but if you spend any time watching him in interviews, it's almost like you can see a little bit of Jack Sparrow in him. And obviously, I don't know Johnny Depp, but it seems like that character really kind of resonates with who he is on some like deep level.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I have to say, when I first saw him play Jack Sparrow, I was kind of like, this is a little bit weird. But as you see the movie's progression, like, that's perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, you guys were just talking about in a recent episode, you know, he made those appearances in Disneyland recently to promote the new movie. And that's something he has done so many times. He's dressed up as Jack Sparrow and appeared, you know, wherever, children's hospitals or public events. And there have always been rumors about him showing up in the parks, which may or may not have been true until now. But I don't think an actor does that unless a character really kind of speaks to them deep down. I say this too about Bette Midler and Winifred Sanderson from Hocus Pocus. You know, she always is kind of going back to that character and looking for reasons to go back to that character or dress up as it. And, you know, you don't often see actors doing that like for free.
Right. We actually were in Disneyland in October and we talked to a cast member, and it was just a random incident that we were talking to the cast member. He was running the trolley back and forth and he was like telling us stories about Disneyland, and we ended up taking like 14 back and forth trips when we were only supposed to take one just because it was so much fun talking to him.
We're in California Adventure.
California Adventure, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
And he was telling us a story about how Johnny Depp comes into the parks all the time.
Yeah, I believe it. I was once in Hollywood Studios and I had a cast member friend who was working there, and they were saying, you know, this is hush hush, but Johnny Depp is in the park kind of incognito coming back and forth from backstage to front of park. And he was there. I guess his daughter was sick at the time, not like critically, but she was just not feeling well. And so he was looking for some sort of special merchandise. He'd come to Hollywood Studios just for that, to cheer his daughter or some family member of his up, something like that. So I think he's one of those celebrities. He's in that club with like John Stamos and Steven Tyler and Neil Patrick Harris and Jennifer Goodwin, these celebrities who are genuinely diehard Disney fans like the rest of us. And they listen to these podcasts and they go to the same websites and blogs as the people, you know, we know who are doing these guest columns for them and everything. And they're famous, but they're like true blue Disney fans.
Did you hear that, Connie? Johnny Depp could be listening to this podcast.
I just listened to John Stamos and I was like, wait a minute.
Connie, if you could choose, would you rather John Stamos or Johnny Depp listen to your podcast?
Oh,
Bruce, that's too tricky. I know. I don't know. Oh man, that's John Stamos. I think I want to say John Stamos only. I mean, come on, Full House. Who didn't love that show? And that episode where they went to Walt Disney World, like that was the perfect vacation.
The house beats the mouse, parts one and two.
The best.
Love it.
All right. I can't believe I just chose. I can't believe you made me do that.
I have a weird feeling that you and Aaron are going to do a podcast together. I'm going to get cut out somehow.
Yeah. It's fine.
You guys like the same exact stuff. It's pretty funny.
Well, yeah, you did a much better job on the spot than I did.
You can just take a seat back, Bruce, if you'd like. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I keep going. I'll just listen now.
No,
I'm just kidding.
Okay, so let's get into... So Bruce mentioned earlier, we haven't read your book yet. We're excited to read it. And I kind of... I'm glad that we didn't read it yet because I feel like I have more questions about the book and like reasons for us to read it and, you know, who this book is for and just, you know, let's talk about it now. I'm excited about it because Epcot is something that it's a park that is very, very near and dear to my heart. I don't know about Bruce. It's never really been Bruce's favorite park.
Well, here's what I've said this on the show many times. It's every time I go to Disney, people always ask us, hey, what are your favorite parks? Rate them, you know, 1 through 4. And every time I go, my ratings change. And right now, Epcot's kind of on the lower end of my ratings at the moment.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, Epcot's such a weird park. It's weird in so many ways. I was actually just talking with Dan Heaton from the Tomorrow Society podcast the other week, and we were talking about how weird the 1980s were. Just as a decade, like it was all about celebrating the weird, from Cyndi Lauper to Weird Al to what was his Bobcat Goldthwait or whatever his name was. Weird. So everything weird was in vogue, and it was just sort of celebrated for its weirdness and its individuality. And you know, Epcot is very much an expression of the 1980s. One of the things I write about in this book, which is really a book of issues, like tackling the big issues, the big questions that kind of hang over Epcot. And one of those is, well, what is Epcot supposed to do about the 1980s? And I argue that the 1980s are as inherent to Epcot's identity, permanently inherent to its identity, as the 1950s are to Disneyland. And you can make this argument really about any of the Disney parks, you know, the late 80s, early 90s for Hollywood Studios, the 90s for Animal Kingdom, so on and so forth. These parks reflect and will always reflect the time in which they open. And so I argue in the book, and I kind of make a case for it, that Epcot needs to embrace this, but embrace it in a not in a tacky way, which one can do when embracing the 80s.
Like Milli Vanilli style.
But watch in more of a Stranger Things style, sort of like a classy, subtle embrace of the decade, because it will always be there. But it's weird in that way, but it's also weird in that we are now entering what I think might be a third generation or iteration of Epcot, right? So there was Epcot Center, and those who remember it very fondly. Like if you spend any time on fan message boards, people are just fervent with their love for 1980s Epcot Center. And then you have just Epcot lowercase, right? Of this started in like 94 to 96. And now we're on the cusp of this new, as yet unknown iteration of Epcot that I think we might learn a lot about in a couple of weeks at the D23 Expo. But sure. So I think people's feelings about Epcot are often determined by which of these generations they first discovered the park in. And so I don't know, Bruce, I forget, when was your first time at Epcot?
Like the 2000s. So mine was later in life.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I mean, that probably was not Epcot's, you know, crowning year.
Right.
Right.
You know, there was the big, the wand and was that there?
Yes, it was. It absolutely was there.
So, you know, you had that, and you had a lot of these, then especially aging attractions in Future World. I mean, they've spruced some of them up since then, right? Like Soarin' and Test Track. But I mean, just everything was really aging back then. And this was the case for a long time. It was just everything seemed dated. There was nothing future about it at all. And there was this effort to pander to children in so many of the Future World attractions, and even things with like KidCot and World Showcase. And all of this was a response to Epcot Center, which Disney fans like me loved, but children in the 80s often said was boring. And so there was just there's this weird clash going on in, you know, in the early 2000s, and that was true for about 10 years. So if you discovered Epcot during that like 10-year period and really kind of up to the present day, as millions of Disney World guests and now fans have, then yeah, I think it totally makes sense that at least part of that park probably isn't going to resonate with you.
Right. And I think that's exactly the case. Like I feel like it's a park where where I went there for the first time later in my life as I was a little bit older with my children, there's not much for me to have reminisced about when I was a kid. It's kind of I look around and you know,
Ellen's Energy Adventure, for instance, when we go in there, I immediately like reflect on, I do reflect on the 80s. I feel like that's when that came out. It was like, it brings me back to that time of like Michael Jackson's leather jacket and a boombox. You know, that's what I think of. And I'm like, I think this needs a little updating.
Yeah, I don't know.
Connie loves it. Connie loves all 80s. She like reminisces about the 80s all the time.
Wouldn't refer to Ellen as 80s. That's more of like 90s for me.
Yeah, 90s. Yeah, that whole thing is an interesting discussion too. And I get into this in the book a little bit too. You know, Ellen was sort of this shooting star at Disney in the early 90s, and she had her TV show Ellen, not the talk show, but the sitcom, and it was Disney produced, and it was, you know, this big thing, and she was everywhere. She was in Epcot, and she was in Hollywood Studios. You know, the old Rider Stop before that, it was By the Book was the name of that little gift shop, and that was themed to the shop that she owned on her sitcom. And so she was just this big rising star. And then, you know, there was all this controversy that came with Ellen in the 90s, and so Disney sort of took a step back from that. But even that, like that whole chapter from history plays out right there in the middle of Epcot. And it does, you walk into that building, it takes you right back to that time period. And it's very interesting how, you know, another thing I talk about is as fans, we don't expect a movie to keep up with the times. Like, we can watch a movie from the 80s, and if it's a great movie, we don't complain that it seems like it's from the 80s. But a theme park attraction, we do. That does bother us. And so, like, the expectation is different. And that's interesting, too. Why is it that, you know, Back to the Future is wonderful as a 1980s film, but Captain EO strikes guests as, you know, inexcusably old and outdated? Different set of expectations. But I will say the thing about the 80s that does survive or should survive at Epcot is that it was also, as much as it was a decade about weirdness, it was also a decade of optimism. There was just this real sense that, like, this cool technology was on the horizon, like computers were here. You know?
Yes.
And we could do anything, and all illnesses and disease will be solved, and the world peace is within reach. And like, that is the optimism of Epcot Center, both Future World and World Showcase. Like, the whole park is devoted to the single loftiest aspiration that any human being could ever have, which is world peace, right? And that's what it's all about. It's a sincere, genuine belief that was within reach. There was this song in the original Spaceship Earth called Tomorrow's Child. You know, it was all about, that's who we were. We were tomorrow's child, and we were going to be the generation to solve this.
Yes.
That's what made the 80s awesome, and I want that to stay in Epcot.
I could drop not the mic. Agree with you more. Yes. Boom, we're done here, everybody. Yeah, no, seriously, because I'm sad that Bruce didn't get to feel that, you know, as a kid. I think that if I could bring you back, Bruce, that would be the park I would take. I don't think I would even take you to the Magic Kingdom. I would take you to Epcot in the 80s to feel that energy and to feel that it was inspiring. And you were, you know, we were young kids at the time, but it just felt like we were the future, and that, like you said, the technology was cutting edge, and that there was just so much happening, and you couldn't wait to see. And I don't want that to ever disappear in Epcot, and like, I want to bring it back.
I for one enjoy Captain EO, by the way.
No,
okay,
I know you did.
Me too. I mean, you guys mentioned Michael Jackson, but I didn't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing.
No, it wasn't a bad thing that I thought of that. It was just that that's what I thought of when I went in there. But I do like Captain EO. I did like, although I do like the Pixar short that they had recently as well. But I did miss Captain EO when I go there.
Yeah, and you know, even though Captain EO was not like an opening day attraction, it was slightly later into Epcot Center, and then it crossed the bridge into the second iteration of Epcot. But I really think that attraction brought with it the best mission statement for the park. There's that song, "We Are Here to Change the World." I mean, that is Epcot's ethos, and it was captured in this incredibly catchy Michael Jackson pop song, of all places. But yeah, I mean, who would have thought that like the brand ambassador for Epcot would have been Michael Jackson? But that's it. And that's why that attraction, I think, has such staying power beyond just people's love for Michael Jackson after his passing. But it's something about that message sort of, I guess, you know, resonates with what Epcot says to people.
And we can attest to that because our kids who didn't grow up knowing Michael Jackson loved that attraction.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome to hear.
Yeah, they loved it. They would always enjoy going to see that.
Mm-hmm. They're sad that it was gone. I mean, like you said, the Disney and Pixar short film, I think that needs to be somewhere. I just wish they didn't take it away out of, you know, I wish it wasn't
replacing Captain EO.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like maybe that should be, I feel like that should be in Hollywood Studios somewhere. I don't know.
It would probably fit better there. You know, there is this history of celebrating the movies in Future World. I mean, you know, the Great Movie Ride and really all of Hollywood Studios began, as I'm sure you guys know, as a proposed pavilion for Future World. There was going to be like a movie pavilion in Future World. So there's a historical connection, I guess, an argument one can make to justify it being there. But for me, anytime one attraction goes away, and this is not just Epcot, but any theme park, like it's always a debate with guests, right? Like, are Disney parks museums, or should we always be making way for the new?
Yeah.
And I just think if something new comes along, it needs to be as good as or better than what it replaces, and it needs to be about something. You know, with Epcot, for example, the attraction that all the original Epcot Center fans miss the most is Horizons, right? You just log on any Disney message board, spend 10 minutes there, you will find someone complaining that Horizons closed. And
not me, just kidding. It's me.
did you guys get to do Horizons ever?
Bruce didn't.
I did not.
I don't think you did, Bruce. Yeah.
I was a very deprived child.
Well, I didn't either, or at least I don't recall ever getting to experience it in person. So my experience, you know, has been through YouTube later, but it really is just such a beautiful, just artistic work, really. I mean, it's so much more than a ride, Horizons, but it also very much existed in the 1980s. So, you know, one of the reasons it left is because people were complaining at the time that nobody was like, I love Horizons. People were complaining that Disney wasn't updating it. So the thing is, I make the point in the book, it's not that we need Disney to rebuild Horizons. We just need Disney to build attractions that inspire us to look toward our horizons, right? So that it's about that thing, that feeling, that sentiment that we want to get from the park's central theme.
So next land should be 80s land.
Hey, I would be there.
Me too.
Yeah. I would,
with Brewster, you even have to.
I would be like a kid all over again and be like, yes, I finally got to go to Disney in the 80s.
Aw, I'm sorry, Bruce. Well, I'm looking at the chapters. There's 11 chapters, and you go into, so you talk about, it says chapter one, Ellen's Energy Adventure, chapter two, Mission Space, chapter three, Test Track. What do you do specifically on those chapters? What do you talk about the attraction? Like, do you give the history of the attraction? Tell us more about that.
So the book is divided into two parts. Part one is Future World. Part two is World Showcase. And there is one attraction or one chapter for each attraction. And so that's structured a little differently than my other books. And it really gives me the opportunity to take all the time I need to dive into and dissect and kind of get to the heart of each attraction. So often it starts with a history. And what's cool about Epcot is I was actually able to uncover some new things. And that's not always possible in the age where, as I said, of the internet, everything about Disney is known. But what's weird about Epcot, again, is that word weird. Even though it is 11 years younger than Magic Kingdom as a theme park, right? It's existed for 11 fewer years. It somehow has more history than Magic Kingdom just because so much has changed. There was just a whole lot of digging to do, and I actually worked on a few things with Walt Disney Archives and Walt Disney Imagineering to uncover some stuff. And so often the attraction discussions begin with a history, and then once that foundation is laid, it's then really about, as I said before, what makes us love this attraction, or occasionally what makes people not love an attraction so much, as is the case with like Circle of Life, which hasn't been so popular. Mission Space often isn't popular. And so it's about answering these questions. And then on top of that, the ultimate thing about the book is answering these fan controversies. Things like, when is it appropriate for a character to appear in World Showcase? Case in point, Anna and Elsa in the Norway Pavilion. What role should a government play, like the Chinese government, play as a sponsor of a theme park attraction, or a corporation for that matter? You know, should the Disney Corporation sort of defer to a corporation like Chevrolet, or should it be more about the Disney brand? Now, these are questions that fans have been debating for years and years. And what I realized in the course of writing this book is that the best way to finally answer these questions, or to have like tools for answering the questions, is to use the attractions themselves as the tools, as the texts for answering these. And so, for example, with the character question, what's really cool is that you can take something like the Three Caballeros in Mexico, and you can compare that to the role that Anna and Elsa play in Norway, and get down to the bottom of what actually is bothering fans about characters in these rides, and why is it that people seem to be bothered by Anna and Elsa in Norway, but not so much by the Three Caballeros in Mexico. I don't think it can be something inherent in Frozen. It can't be just that Frozen is popular. And so actually, I think the book comes to some really interesting conclusions about all of that. But the attractions are the answers. When we look at those and how they work and what it is that people respond to in them, kind of all of these controversies that have haunted fans for years suddenly become clear. And to me, that was the most exciting thing about writing the book.
Where did you do your research for these facts, or to get the history behind these attractions or the pavilions? Where did you go to get your information from?
So it really depends on what I'm researching, right? And it's a lot of time in books from the time period. Actually, they don't do this with all their theme parks, but Epcot, or the Walt Disney World Resort, was really great about publishing a lot of literature in the early days of Epcot. And it's all out of print now, but you can still find copies. And so there's actually a book by a guy named Robert Beard that was published by the company that was a guide to Epcot Center, much of it written before the park even opened. And it is chock full of information about what the thought was behind these attractions. And it's often things that you don't even pick up on when you're just writing them, but it's so helpful for a discussion 35 years later.
Do you remember the name of that book?
I think it's Epcot Creating the World of Tomorrow, off the top of my head. I think that's what it's called. And there are multiple editions over the years, but if you can get your hands on the 1981-82 publication of that, I mean, that's really gold. But often, you know, you've got to go beyond just the corporate source. And so I spent a lot of time going into contemporaneous newspaper and magazine publications from the early days of the park. So I wanted to know when the Living Seas opened in 1982, or actually I think it might have been 83, something like that. Well, what did Los Angeles Times say about it? What did the Orlando Sentinel say about it? What did a local newspaper, in Apopka or in some little small town in Central or Southern Florida, what did they say about it? Who were they crediting with developing these things? And one of the little mysteries that this book, I think, has been able to solve is who was the original narrator for Spaceship Earth? And you would think that would be a clear matter of historical record, but as it turns out, that has been a mystery for many years. You've got Marty Sklar insisting it was one thing. You've got newspaper publications, even going back to the early 80s, offering conflicting reports about who narrated it. There's confusion because some of the same people were narrating attractions in Magic Kingdom and Epcot at the same time. And so it was really a matter of digging into these newspaper reports to kind of clear up this mess that has persisted for years. And spoiler alert, Marty Sklar was not right.
Really?
Yeah. So that's actually in an appendix in the book. I guess I didn't finish answering your earlier question, but after part one and part two, the book ends with an epilogue called The State of the Center. And it's really about sizing up what's happening in Epcot now and where Epcot maybe could and should go in the future. And then it ends with two appendices, which answer these questions. First, who was the original narrator for Spaceship Earth? And then secondly, is that really Steve Jobs? And that geeky animatronic toward the end of Spaceship Earth. Is that Steve Jobs? Is it supposed to be Steve Jobs? Is it fair to argue that it's Steve Jobs? And here again, you would think that there would be a clear answer to this, but there isn't. And this, to me, as just like a researcher and as a complete nerd, this is the most interesting thing about Disney fandom, is when things aren't clear. And like, we as fans get to be the detectives and come to our own, you know, conclusions about it. It's just super exciting stuff. Same thing as with my Magic Kingdom books. Nobody knows when Spaceship Earth opened in Magic, or I'm sorry, Space Mountain. Nobody knows the day it opened in Magic Kingdom. There are all these conflicting reports. You go back to the 1970s, a newspaper, New York Times says one thing, the Orlando Sentinel says another. Like, that's crazy. How is that not?
I know.
How do they not have it at, right? Exactly. Yeah. But it is so much fun. And I think that maybe it's done intentionally. You never know. That's kind of like what I like to think.
Well, it keeps the mystery alive, and it keeps people going to do some research and dig deep and talk about it, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Yeah, it makes us all crazy fans.
Yeah, like, we erased our first episode, so no one knows when we really started.
That's a great idea. I really need to do that.
Yeah. Ooh, ours are, pretty bad. Don't listen to the first few. Anyway.
What was the one thing that surprised you doing the research for this book?
That's a good question. I will say, I don't think I knew how much I didn't know about Epcot. Right, so here I am, like, I've been podcasting for 13 years, and I've written some books on Disney, and, you know, I've probably read God knows everything out there about Disney, and, you know, I feel like I kind of know my stuff, right? I don't know everything, but I know a lot about Disney, and I kind of felt like, yeah, I've got the gist of what Epcot is and what it has been, and I was in for a real surprise when I started digging in. There are just so many little chapters of Epcot history, things that were open for a few weeks or little shows or things that were said by somebody in Imagineering or something, that it's all just interesting. And the real treat in writing a book about Disney is that you get to justify spending the time doing this research, and then I get to share that research with other people. And so I'm just like a kid in a candy store, like, oh my gosh, guys, look what I found, you know. And that's what I'm doing in the book. And who knew a park that I've been alive for most of Epcot's existence, and I've been going there most of my life, I should know pretty much everything, but there was so much I didn't. And it's crazy that so much history can live in a place so young.
I think really that's cool. And that circles back to what we said in the beginning, where people need to kind of take their time and slow down. And because even if you've been to Disney 5 times, there's still so many things that you haven't seen, no matter how many times you visited in those 5 visits.
100%. And, you know, I always say, I think maybe like the secret to wisdom in life, if I can get a little philosophical here, is that is realizing that you don't know what you don't know, and you can't know what you don't know. And we will never stop learning from these parks. I mean, that's really what I'm realizing, that not only learning about them in terms of like factually what went into making them, because there are a million stories. You know, every person who worked on that park has a lifetime of stories that in some way might have mattered to the park. But then there's also so much we can just learn by like extrapolating from our experiences there and applying them to our own lives. So that's why the Disney fandom is so rich. There's just so much to get out of it. It's just this like eternal fountain of just inspiration. That's why it's art, really. That's another argument that I'm making in this book series, is that, yes, theme parks are fun. They are. They're super fun, and they should be enjoyed for fun. And I hope that the book has fun with them. But they also really are artworks. And I think we would not respond to them the way we do as fans if there wasn't something truly and inherently artistic and worthwhile in these, beyond just mere diversions or recreations or like, wow, wasn't that drop on the roller coaster fun? There really is something more happening in a Disney park that maybe doesn't happen so much at, say, a Six Flags, that's speaking to us. And like, that really deserves a moment to stop and smell the roses and think about it and reflect on it and appreciate it.
Well said.
Totally. Yes. Lots of great points today, Aaron. I'm really happy you're here today.
I know, this is great.
It is unlocking the magic. That's what we do.
That's what we do. That's what we try to do.
Yeah, I feel like I'm holding the, I've got like a bunch of keys. And like, sometimes I pull out the right one. Right?
This is a great, I think this was a great show. I think fans are going to love the show, talking about Epcot. I want to know a couple things before we wrap up here. What is your favorite attraction in Epcot?
In Epcot. Is it a cop out to say Spaceship Earth?
Absolutely not.
Okay, not at all.
Probably. I mean, it has to be, right? Like, Spaceship Earth is such a masterpiece. It has an unfair advantage because it's very long. And it happens to be one of the most visually interesting buildings in the world. And, you know, Spaceship Earth is just this, it's just so cool to look at. Like, you already love the thing before you even know what's inside it. And then, I mean, it's literally a journey through the history of time. It is the story of us, how we learn to talk to each other, to communicate. You know, and I'm a communications studies and English major, and that's kind of what the ride is about. So it's also like a nice little flashback to college for me. And, you know, I don't necessarily love the final act with Judi Dench, but even though I do love Judi Dench, but, you know, the whole iPad thing at the end is not my favorite. But still, there's so much that goes right in that attraction that I just I never ever grow tired of it.
I'm just glad you didn't say Test Track.
Not a fan?
No, I like it. It's just like, we did the whole podcast about the history, and if you said Test Track, that would have been weird.
That would have been weird. Yeah,
that's right.
That is right. Test Track is fun. It's a fun addition to it. I mean, obviously people are craving some kind of thrill attraction in Epcot, but I think, you know, it's not my favorite either. And I'm glad you said Spaceship Earth, because I agree with you totally.
Yeah, and that is Connie's favorite attraction. Literally, we have to go on there as soon as we get in, and it's the last attraction we have to go on when we leave.
Yeah.
Yes. Don't you feel, I mean, I'm sure people ask you, or maybe you, I don't know, do people ever say like, what's the first thing I should do in
Epcot
Kingdom? I mean, is that your go-to answer for Epcot?
Connie's for sure. Mine is food.
You can't.
Is that your favorite attraction?
Food? Yes. The showcase is mine.
Yeah.
I actually like Living with the Land as well. That's one of my favorite ones too.
Yes. Oh, that is great. That's so great.
All right, I just have two questions. These are from some friends of ours. And one is, speaking of Living with the Land, did you learn something specific that we might not know about with Living with the Land? Anything while you were talking about that attraction in your book?
Things that I learned.
Oh, or gosh. Just like maybe one thing specifically like that surprised you or something that, you know, so that obviously there's probably a lot to talk about. It is my favorite attraction. And interestingly enough, Marty Sklar's favorite attraction.
Well, this is super specific. It's almost just sort of trivia, but I found it interesting because I'd never stopped to think about it before.
Okay.
But the alligators, you know, there's a little section on different kinds of farming, right, in the greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And there's alligator farming. And like alligator farming's a real thing. But why are those alligators in the ride? Like, alligator isn't served anywhere in Walt Disney World. And it had never occurred to me that that's actually there more for the element of surprise, of sort of wowing guests. It's almost like a thrill element. And Living with the Land is the last ride anyone would ever think of as a thrill ride.
Right.
Right.
But it was a great realization for me to think, oh my gosh, this is kind of in a weird way a thrill, because you don't often ride by alligators, and guests do have that moment when that happens, when they're there, if the alligators are there that day and you ride by and you see them right beside you, there's just sort of like, oh my gosh, we're right next to alligators. And you know, they aren't actually being farmed. Like most of the things in that greenhouse are being farmed, and they do actually serve a real purpose in Walt Disney World. But it's cool to me that there was that little attention to, well, let's give guests a little wow moment here. What a cool thing.
Yeah. It does show you that they do think of everything when they build these attractions.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other question was, if you could change one thing specifically about the park, what would it be? Just one thing.
One thing.
Even like one attraction or one little element. I think we kind of talked about it because we wanted to bring sort of the 80s feeling back, that Epcot Center. But
right. So, well, okay, since I already talked about that kind of like bigger picture thing, I'll give a little more specific answer. And it has to do with Mission Space. And I always feel bad about saying this because I have some close friends who absolutely love Mission Space. I'm not one of them, but I understand, you know, just the idea of getting to experience what it's like to launch into space for real is just one of the coolest things. So like that part of the attraction is very cool, but it really looks like you're playing Nintendo 64 when you're watching those graphics. And I always hate, I know that guests roll their eyes when they see that, because you walk in 2017, you see graphics from, you know, the early 2000s, but they look kind of like they're from the mid 90s. And you just kind of think like, oh, this is what Disney does, you know. So I would like to see, really, I don't think Mission Space is the best fit for Future World, period, but they spent a whole bunch of money on it, so it's probably going to be there for a little while. But I would like to see it spruced up at the very least, so that at least it doesn't strike guests as kind of disjointed from 2017.
What they should do with that is they should get you virtual reality headsets as you enter that attraction, and that's what you should wear. Instead of making you super close to the screen, you sit back, you put the virtual reality headset on, and then you go through the experience.
Hey, that is the new trend. I don't know if you guys have heard. I haven't experienced it yet, but SeaWorld has this new, well, they've updated one of their roller coasters to add a VR headset component, and people are raving about it. So I've got to go test that out.
Yes, I heard about that, actually.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing in Epcot that I'd like to see too, is like the technology just be so super cutting edge. And I think that's what people crave when they go to a park like that. Like, they don't want to see anything that's sort of irrelevant to the current time. You know, this is kind of off topic, but we went to the Kennedy Space Center, and just being involved with NASA and seeing things that they're doing, it would be cool if that feeling came back in Epcot, where it's like just everything is so cutting edge. You can be excited for what's next.
And yeah, the problem with that is the technology moves so fast, they could implement something and then 2 years later it could be old.
That's true.
Yeah, you know, I think Interventions had it right in that was sort of the playground for current technology, but these weren't major investments. So all those little exhibits could be changed and kept up to date quite easily. So in my mind, like right now, Intervention should still be open and it should be exhibiting, for example, 3D printing, which I think is a very cool and exciting technology that people still don't really quite understand how it works. Like there should be an exhibit on 3D printing, and there should be an exhibit on, you know, some of this new smartphone technology that can detect cancer just by sense, you know, undetectable sense in people's breath. And like these emerging technologies, there could be little exhibits on these things and interventions. And that's kind of like that attraction's role. And then everything else that requires millions of dollars and can't be updated every year should look at more abstract concepts of, you know, maybe not the specific science of how we're going to solve cancer or how we're going to build machines in the future, but the bigger, broader idea of, well, what can machines do for us? What can health do for us? And sort of get excited about those concepts on a like more abstract, emotional level. That, I think, would be the golden ticket for Future World going forward.
I totally agree.
Question of the show.
Okay.
Where's your favorite place to eat in the showcase?
We didn't really talk about the
I know.
At all.
I had to throw it in there real quick.
I love the showcase. I love, you know, how you mentioned earlier, you know, basically what we're trying to tell, you know, all our listeners is really take the time to absorb your experience, you know, really immerse yourself in the parks and really take the time, because you will wander through the countries, but you really won't realize what you're seeing unless you kind of take the time to go through each one individually. So anyway.
Absolutely. My favorite place, I have to answer carefully, Bruce, because I'm talking about your favorite attraction here.
I know. By the way, people are going to be pumped because this is almost an hour long, and we usually don't do more than 30 minutes because I usually can't sit here. So people are going to be super excited for this episode.
Oh, I am so. That's 100% me rambling.
It's great, though.
They'll be so excited.
Yeah, they're going to be pumped. They ask for it all the time. They literally ask every time we do a live show, hey, if you, we just want you to do a longer episode. And I'm like, no.
Hey, I'm all for more unlocking the magic. So if I can help that make that happen, then I'm excited.
Thank you, Aaron. You're the best.
Okay, favorite restaurant. I'll try to answer this quickly since we're hitting an hour. But I don't even know. I will just say, I'm going to throw out, it's not my favorite, but I will say most improved and maybe one of the most underappreciated, and that is Nine Dragons. For some reason, it has a reputation for being just like throwaway Chinese food. And that is the case, I think, for the quick service Chinese food in the China Pavilion.
Okay.
But hey, guys, if you like Chinese food, which I love, and granted, it's kind of like the American version of Chinese food, but still, give Nine Dragons another chance. If you've never been, or if it's been a number of years, if you've written it off because of old blog reviews, maybe it wasn't always the best restaurant, but it really has improved. And it's very, I think, you know, this is just me and I'm not a food critic, but I think that the food there is good. So I'm going to put my vote behind Nine Dragons.
That's a great one, because that's not one I expected.
That is perfect. Yeah, I love it. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, I'm curious, though. What's your pick? Do you have like a ready to go favorite?
Me or Connie? I like Morocco and then the Japan sushi.
Yes. Pavilion. Okay, yeah. That's great. Morocco is another one. Like people just completely forget that restaurant is there. If every other, well, are you talking about which Morocco?
Either the quick service or the fine dining one.
Okay, but not Spice Road Table.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, if everything else in World Showcase, if all of Walt Disney World is at capacity, you will still find a table at the restaurant in Morocco.
It's true.
One goes there. And Marrakesh, the table service is buried deep in that back of that pavilion. But if you walk back there, you meander through those pathways and you find that restaurant, I'm telling you, the food's pretty good and it's a nice experience. It's very different from the rest of Epcot. And I know the menu sounds kind of scary, but I recently heard Joe Rohde say, every time you travel to a foreign country, you're scared to try the food, and then you eat it and you say, wow, that tastes like chicken. And there's a lot of truth in that.
That's so true.
You know, everything is kind of a variation, but it's not that different. So if the menu scares you, give it a chance because it really is very good too. Marrakesh.
That's how we stumbled upon Morocco. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what happened to us. We sort of, let's just try it. It didn't seem that busy. And so it was, wow, a great experience. And now it's our go. Like, I can just eat around the whole. I mean, there's no place in Epcot that I really don't like. So.
Yeah. But is that your favorite too, though, Marrakesh?
I don't know if I have a number one favorite. I feel like they all lump into, like, I have to, this last trip that we did, we actually ate around the world, and we visited every sort of quick service. And what we did was we meal shared. So we'd get everybody kind of snacked around the world, even though we're ordering a meal. and kind of shared it. And it really kind of opened our eyes to experiencing Epcot in a different way than before. Because usually when we'd go, we'd pick a restaurant, you know, you do your quick service for lunch or whatever. And this time we went everywhere. And I think that was really fun. Don't you think, Bruce?
Yeah, you have to spend time in each individual land in the pavilion because they're all different. And if you don't, like if you just have a fine dining or a sit-down restaurant, you're going to waste an hour and a half in one of those restaurants. And I don't mean waste, but, you know, spend an hour and a half, which is fine. But I feel like you will walk to the restaurant, you'll eat there, and then when you're done, you'll leave, and you'll kind of go on to the next attraction. But if you eat maybe at the quick service or take your time and sample a little bit around, you're going to spend more time wandering through those places.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love what you just said. You've got to spend time in each of the individual pavilions. You know, going back to that, to the early Epcot literature from like 81, 82 – it's very clear that the Imagineers' early plan for Epcot Center is that each pavilion would be a place where you spent upwards of half a day or more.
Wow.
Like in one pavilion, the Imagination Pavilion or the Living Seas, you would spend minimum 3-4 hours, if not half a day or more, in each of these pavilions. And so this would keep you coming back to Epcot over and over again. And that actually was the case. I mean, again, going back to these contemporaneous news reports, newspapers reported that guests were spending the most, like a good portion of their day in one pavilion and so having to come back for repeat visits. And that's crazy to imagine now. Like, can you imagine spending most of your day in any of those Future World pavilions, really. But that was the idea, that there would just be so much and so many big attractions coupled with little exhibits and everything. But it is still a little bit true of World Showcase, as you were saying. So even though that isn't necessarily what we expect from Epcot anymore, I would just encourage people to, if you can, like if you've got these long vacation blocks, which not everyone has, but if you do, like you said, I mean, to eat around the world, what a cool way to experience World Showcase, you know, if you have the time and the budget to do that.
Yeah, and it's tough because if your kids are anywhere from 7 to 14, they're not going to want to do that. But if they're younger than that or older than that, you may be able to convince them. And if they're younger, you just tell them they are.
Yes. Make them.
Yes.
I love Epcot it, by mandate. I love it.
But they've definitely added things now that they didn't have when I was younger to, I think, involve kids more. There's crafts that kids can do. There's games that they can do around the World Showcase, which I think are still really fun and cool. And I don't know, even though Bruce mentioned an age gap of like if they don't want to try things, I think our kids really loved, you know, going to, I don't know, Japan and trying the candy from the store.
Yeah.
And, you know, that Bruce tried coffee and
in a can, warm coffee in a can. That was pretty good, actually.
We got ice and poured it over ice. Wasn't that? It was good.
Anyway. It was good.
So, yeah.
So
that's awesome. That's one thing I've always wanted to do is I want to take a year where each month I go to the pavilion and I buy one of each packaged food item from the gift shop there. So one of every candy, cook, whatever. And then like have a party, invite a bunch of friends over, a house party, and put all of these snacks out. And we have just like a Japan pavilion night, right? Where we're all just sample this smorgasbord of packaged candies and cookies and whatnot from the pavilion. Like that, I live next to Disney World and I've been going there all my life and I've still never experienced World Showcase that way. So there are so many ways to do it.
So many variations, totally.
I have to say, in the Japan Pavilion, that candy shop, or it's not really a candy shop, it's just a shop, but the candy, they do such a good job of making them look good.
Yeah.
Not such a good job of making them taste good, though.
There's been a couple of fails. Yeah, it's hit or miss, but that's the fun. That's like it's just like you said earlier, visiting a country, not knowing what the food would be like, and you just take a chance and risk. That's half the fun.
Totally.
Yeah. So. Bots, or what is it? Every flavor, birdie bots, every flavor beans. That's it.
Aaron, thank you so much. Aaron's book is called The Thinking Fan's Guide to Walt Disney World Epcot. I got it right that time. You can find it on Amazon or his website. Aaron, what's your website again?
Yeah, AaronWallaceOnline.com. All you need to know is my name. That's my handle on Twitter too, at Aaron Wallace. You can find my podcast and my books and anything else I do there.
What's your favorite social platform that people can reach out to you and say hello?
I'm a big Twitter person. I mean, I think I've at least got a profile everywhere at this point, or I'm trying. I'm not always the best with social media, but Twitter, I live there. So if you want to hear my rantings and ravings about, you know, whatever is the topic of the day, then Aaron Wallace on Twitter, or just go to my website, AaronWallaceOnline.com.
Awesome.
Perfect. Nice and simple, Bruce. We got to work on
it. I know. Ours is so complicated.
We're everything online. Anyway.
Just go to the website for us, and then you can try to find it from there, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, right. That always works.
Totally. Well, thank you, Aaron, again. It was always a blast. Can't wait to... Actually, you know, when we get down to Orlando, we should definitely do a meetup.
I would love that. Let's for sure make that happen. And awesome. Thank you again for having me on another time. And let me thank your listeners, too, for letting me spend some time with you guys once again. I appreciate it. And this has been a lot of fun.
Cool, man. I think this is going to be a good show. You know it's going to be a good show when an hour goes by and I'm not. Well, actually, I'm still here.
We are all awake. Granted, I just had coffee, but I actually give you guys the credit for keeping me up. So it's been a blast.
Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, guys.
Well, that was a bunch of fun.
That was fun. That was a really long episode,
too. I could literally talk to Aaron for hours and hours and hours.
That was my gift to everybody on Facebook who said they wanted a longer episode, and I usually don't ever give it to them. Not that I don't want to give them a longer episode, but sometimes I just get...
Just admit it. I'm boring. So it's just when it's just you and I, you get bored of me. Just no, say
it's
not, it.
It's just admit little, it. I get a little antsy.
It's fine. It's
but that right. was fun with Aaron. That was a good talk. I liked talking to Aaron. He's kind of like us, you know? He just likes talking Disney and gets passionate about it and likes the history. And when we asked him what his favorite attractions were at Epcot, we all had similar ones.
Yeah.
He even liked my 80s Michael Jackson jacket and white glove and all that stuff.
It was a lot of fun. So where can you guys find Aaron?
His podcast is Zippity Doo Pod on iTunes, and his website is Aaron Wallace Online.
Nice and simple.
If you're like me, AaronWallace.
Oh boy, Bruce is
I had to spell
spelling
it out.
On air.
It's like, I don't know how to spell Aaron. I wouldn't know how to spell Wallace.
Yeah.
But so you know what?
Fumble up.
There you go. Or just go to our website, unlockingthemagic.com, and go to our show notes, and then you just click the blue link.
That's much easier.
That's what I would do.
Yes. Perfect.
All right. Thanks to our sponsor.
Enchanted Escapes Travel. If you're looking to book your next Disney vacation, they will do that for you. No cost for you at all. Visit them at enchanted-escapes.com.
Yeah, the thing that I like is that it doesn't cost you any money, and they do all the work for you. Just Bruce send them a quick that. Note saying, hey, I want to eat it here.
Bruce.
Do you magic.
Do you magic.
That's Let's what go. I like. Isn't that the best?
Yes.
And then, yeah, I love that. So on Twitter, I am WDW Unlock Magic. If you want to say hello to me. Facebook, again, we remembered that. We said that in the beginning of the show, Unlocking the Magic. And on Instagram, we are Unlock the Magic. We got to do something about these different names on different social networks.
We're working on it. Yeah. I like Aaron's whole thing. It's like, Aaron Wallace, that's all you have to know. As long as you know how to spell it.
That's true. You do have you to do that. You can find him. But you should go check out our website to get Connie's packing list, too, over at unlockingthemagic.com. And don't forget that we go live every Monday night over on Facebook. That's it for me, Connie.
That is it for me. So thanks, everybody, again. And
we'll see you.